Welcome to episode number 15 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, the show where we talk about wellness, mental health, leadership, and what it takes to have a wellness culture within your organization. My name is Conrad Weaver. I'm a filmmaker, podcast host, and the director of the award-winning film PTSD 911. You know, this time of year can be especially stressful for many of us, and it's sometimes easy to think that a drink will help us relax. But what do you do when that drink turns into a problem? Tara Rivera has worked as a treatment advocate for almost 7 years and has helped countless people begin their journey to wellness. Tara is an adjunct professor of addiction studies at Anna Marie College and is a person in long-term recovery herself. This past January, she celebrated 26 years of continued sobriety. Today on the podcast, we talk about what to do when you find yourself drinking too much, how that can affect your job, your future, and how to get the help that you need. Stay tuned for this important conversation. Hey, I really appreciate you listening to the podcast. And if you think others would too, please subscribe and share. This helps us get the word out to others. If you're a peer support leader for your agency, or if you're in any leadership position in public safety, I want to encourage you to purchase the PTSD 911 film and toolkit for your agency. This is a valuable tool to help get your people talking and working on a wellness culture within your organization. Start out the new year with the PTSD 911 film and the accompanying toolkit that you'll be able to use for years to come. By the way, the toolkit also includes another entire documentary called Risk Lock, The Martial Arts Influence on Police Use of Force. You get two for one, and we've had more than 70 organizations make this purchase, and you should too. Check the link in the show notes for more information. And thanks again for listening, and now here's my interview with Tara Rivera. Well, Tara, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. It's so good to have you on the program today.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
So tell me about you and about your connection to first responders.
Yeah. So kind of feel like that's always a loaded question. I'm Tara. I'm a treatment advocate. I work currently at Banyan's Clearbrook Treatment Center in Massachusetts. I am always tell people kind of first and foremost, I'm a woman in long-term recovery. So that kind of, I think, shapes who I am and what I do and my why. And that's usually kind of what I lead with when people kind of say, hey, so tell me about yourself. You know, that's kind of like the first thing I say. It's a huge part of who I am and my life and how I live my life. So I think that's probably being a treatment advocate and being a woman in recovery. Also being a mom, right? Because that's a huge part of my life too. But those are probably like the major defining factors of kind of who I am.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your long-term recovery. Because that's, you chose your hard, right? You had to choose your hard and you did the hard thing of being sober and getting yourself back to a healthy place.
Yeah. It's definitely not easy. And I feel like we don't choose it one time. We choose it daily, you know, because life is obviously not easy. And, you know, we make that choice every single day to, you know, kind of put those big girl pants on, big boy pants on and, you know, handle things. So, and doing it substance free, which is not easy. So, yeah.
Yeah. Especially in a world that really promotes drinking and partying and all that kind of stuff. It's, you know, you see that everywhere, and especially during the holidays here, you know, even more pronounced. And having the holidays being sometimes the most stressful part of the year for a lot of people, and it can be easy to jump into that. Well, I'll just have a drink to kind of ease the stuff. So how do you do that? How do you keep yourself on the straight and narrow, so to speak?
Well, it's been 26 years I've been in recovery now. So it's kind of second nature, and almost everybody that knows me knows that I don't drink. But I would say really early on, a big piece of it for me was not going to places where there was alcohol for at least, I would say maybe like the first year to up to 3 years. I changed people, places, and things, right? So people say that, you know, in order to really make those changes in your life and to withstand and be strong in your recovery, you need to change the people that you're hanging out with. You need to change the places in which you are hanging out and change the things that you do. So I did a lot of that. I just really removed myself from a lot of situations. And it kind of was interesting over time. My friends or, be like, hey, we really miss you. And I would just be honest and be like, I just have a really tough time being around that. You know, it just makes me uncomfortable. I miss you too, but maybe we can, grab some breakfast or lunch or get some coffee. And then it kind of got to the point where people understood that. And if they wanted me to be in that environment with them, they would choose to have alcohol-free parties. Fast forward 26 years later, I can be around it, but the majority of the people in my life don't drink. So, and after all these years, obviously it doesn't bother me anymore, but, ironically enough, it doesn't bother me in terms of, struggling with wanting to drink. That obsession was removed a long time ago, but, more so it saddens me to see people, I don't want to say socially drinking because, that's having a glass of wine at dinner is not really a big deal. But if I'm at a party and I see when someone makes that turn where they've probably had one too many, it just makes my heart hurt. And so I choose just not to be in environments like that.
Yeah. And for some people, and I include myself in that, where we haven't necessarily had that problem, what would you say to those of us like me who should I be drinking in front of someone like yourself who has been in recovery?
Yeah.
That's for me, it's always been kind of like, I get uncomfortable even having one glass of wine, at a dinner.
Yeah. Well, I like that. I think that's really cool that you feel that way. I think it's personal preference. If you are uncomfortable doing it, I would say don't do it, right? If you feel comfortable doing it, I would say go for it. But, just be mindful. I think I don't know that a lot of people mind it the way that I do. I think I'm a little unique, and I think it's probably because of the work that I do. And I'm just constantly looking for red flags, and I'm just worried and concerned about all people when they're drinking. So I kind of watch in a completely different way than I think if somebody in recovery that doesn't do the work that I do. So I think just kind of have to know your audience, but always go with your gut. I tell people always go with your gut. If you're uncomfortable doing something, there's usually a reason why.
Yeah. There's been situations where I know there'd be people who, are perhaps just recently in recovery. And I definitely like, okay, just no, we're just going to have water. We're just going to, do the right thing here.
Yeah.
But there's other times when I know someone that perhaps they've been in recovery for years, like yourself. And I'm like, well, they're probably okay with me having a drink, but I'm always hesitant.
Yeah.
Don't know what they think and don't know what, maybe I should just ask.
Yeah. Well, with the holidays approaching, I would encourage those who are listening, if you have friends that are in recovery, what a great opportunity to find interesting new drinks, right? So I went to an event a while back and they had a lot of different mocktails, and they had like a lemon lime seltzer with like blueberries and mint in it. So there's lots of really cool different things that you can do to make it fun and festive and still not include alcohol. So, I would encourage listeners to do some of those kind of neat things to introduce fun, non-alcoholic drinks, and still show that you can enjoy the time,
Sure. I read recently in a travel magazine that there are even some cruise lines who are providing cruises that are non-alcoholic. There's no alcohol served on the cruise ship.
I love that.
Because they said there's more and more people that cruise are saying, hey, I don't want to drink. I don't want to have alcohol. And so I forget which cruise line it was, but they were like, hey, let's just do a whole cruise that there's no alcohol, which is amazing.
It. Yeah, I love it. That would be great. I know I listen to a Christian radio station called K-Love, and they have like K-Love cruises. And I was like, I'm not a big cruise fan. I like to have 2 feet planted on the ground. But if I ever did decide to do a cruise, it would probably be a K-Love cruise.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I listen to K-Love too when I have an opportunity to do that. So we don't always get that here locally. But that's a great channel, great station. Yeah. Well, that's a topic we didn't plan on going down, but I'm glad we did. So tell me a little bit about what you do now and how that fits into what we're trying to do here with first responders.
Yeah. So I was raised by a Gold Star mother, is another probably really big definer for me. My parents were both struggling in their own addiction as I was growing up. So we lived in a duplex. So I say my grandmother raised me because, you know, we essentially were all living in the same house and my parents were really not available. You know, they were very caught up in their own addiction. They spent a lot of time either in their bedroom or the basement. There's a lot of people coming and going. There was a lot of chaos. There was a lot of trauma. It was not a pleasant environment to grow up in, but my grandmother was the calm in my storm. She was my saving grace. She's the one who, you know, taught me, you know, to bathe every day and to brush my hair and to do my nails and wear makeup and like be a girl and, you know, do all that stuff. But she was the only one that hugged me, and showed me any kind of affection in my life. So she was a Gold Star mother. So I had two uncles who were both in Vietnam. One was in the Army, one was in the Marines. My uncle that was in the Army, unfortunately, passed after 2 months, stepped on a landmine. Mm-hmm. And that was December 12th, 1970. And so growing up with this household with, you know, one side was kind of like normal, calm, loving. And then, you know, the side in which I lived on was kind of full of chaos and trauma. Every December, that loving household turned dark. So my grandmother very vividly would share with us, you know, when we were kids, what had happened and, you know, how she, you know, she knew that as soon as she saw the two soldiers coming to the door, what news they were bringing and how devastated she was. And, you know, they had to medicate her for the first, you know, like week or so because she just was beside herself and couldn't handle it. And then from that moment on for 10 years, she wore full black, black top, black bottom, socks, shoes, purses, everything was black. She wore nothing but black for 10 years. Every December, she kept the curtains closed. She never put up a Christmas tree. She never did Christmas decorations. It was a very sad time of year. And so that's kind of how I was raised. So it's kind of funny. She passed in 2018 now. Up until she passed, I didn't really like Christmas either. And when she passed, I actually kind of felt like I don't have to honor her in that way. Like she's with him now, she's at peace. And I struggle with trying to enjoy Christmas because I was just not raised enjoying it. It was a sad time. But you know, that being said, my other uncle who was in the Marines did end up doing two tours at 19. And he came back with a drug problem. And I watched him my entire life struggle with alcoholism and drug addiction. And he had the biggest heart in the entire world. He was an amazing human and he was the best uncle. And I knew that he loved me and he would always be there for me. But, you know, I don't know that I ever really actually saw him sober. Lots of flashbacks when he, you know, when we were in early childhood, I remember, you know, he would just like run out of the house and go into the woods and my father would have to like kind of find him and, you know, get him back on track and, you know, get him back into the house. And, you know, so I grew up, you know, very, kind of, and I grew up next to an Army base too, where my grandfather was stationed. My grandfather was also in the Army. So that was kind of like just a big part of like the culture in our life. And I have lots of other, you know, family members that serve today or have served. So, about 7 years ago, I started doing this work as a treatment advocate. And so for the last 7 years, I've been working, trying to help other people who are struggling with their own addiction, find their recovery, you know, doing those phone calls, you know, de-escalating situations, calming people's nerves, helping them like understand what treatment looks like and what levels of care and how they can qualify, how I can help them get in and get started on their journey. And about 5 years ago, the organization I was working with had started a first responder program. And I was just beside myself excited. You know, I was like, this is great. We can specifically help, you know, police officers and firefighters and veterans and corrections officers. And so I kind of like took off running and started from that point about 5 years in now, working with employee assistance programs for like the state police and the Department of Corrections, local police departments, fire departments, veteran services. And it just kind of exploded from there, right? It was already kind of ingrained in me. I had such, honor for, you know, our first responders, that to be able to serve them in this way. I wasn't able to save my uncle. You know, I lost him in early 2000s in a veteran's homestead. He literally drank himself to death. And today I have an opportunity to make a difference in someone else's life where I wasn't able to help him. And I can talk to families, you know, on a level of, I get it. You know, I mean, I was a kid when I was going through it with my uncle. But I very vividly remember lots of, you know, incidences, unfortunately. And I feel, I can feel, you know, their frustration and their worry and their fear, with losing their loved one. So it's an honor and a privilege to be able to help them in that way. I help everybody who calls me. It's not just first responders, but I definitely have a special place in my heart for them. And for not being a first responder, being accepted, and, you know, for people to be able to reach out to me and feel comfortable and confident and trust me with their first responders is, you know, to me, it's like, check the box. Like, I've arrived, you know, I've made it. And it makes me feel really good to be able to be kind of part of that team.
That trust thing is a huge thing with first responders, especially because they oftentimes don't want to be found out, so to speak, you know, and it's a huge stigma thing that still exists today. What did you guys see when you first opened this for first responders? Did you see an immediate response to that, or was that kind of a slow burn?
It was an immediate response. So I think with some segments, it was immediate. Some segments, it was a little bit slower. I would say probably the most immediate when we opened the unit, it was actually first responders and frontline staff. So we do first responders, and then we do healthcare and behavioral health professionals. So immediately we saw nurses, especially post-COVID, we saw a huge uptick in nurses coming in for substance use treatment. And then immediately, I think, corrections officers I saw very, you know, fairly frequently. So I think it's just that on the job thing, right? You have a tough shift, you're going to go out to drink with your buddies after work, and you're going to kind of decompress and talk about those things. And there's a ton of forced overtime and, you know, troubles with administration. Not that that's not the same with all entities that, you know, work in the first responder role, but those were the two, I think, that I saw in the very beginning, very, very quickly and consistently.
You know, we noticed that, I know from the FOP's survey they did, that internal stressor is the top stressor for law enforcement. And I'm sure it's probably the same for other, you know, agencies as well. But, you know, having those kind of stresses, you know, creates, you know, kind of a pain relief, right? And that's often what alcohol is and what drug use is. It's relieving that pain. So when someone, you know, calls you guys or comes to you, are they mandated to come, or is this voluntarily?
Good question. So it is volunteer in the, if you think about it, because it's not a locked facility. So they have to, you know, willingly walk through the door, and they have to willingly make a decision to stay every day through their treatment. That being said, if it's a nurse there, they could be involved in Massachusetts. We have a program called SARP. So if they've gotten in trouble on the job with diversion or any type of, you know, intoxication on the job, it's a requirement for them to go to treatment. That being said, they still can choose to leave, and then they would have to, you know, kind of suffer the repercussions of that program that they're involved in. With first responders, sometimes they come willingly, with a, you know, highly suggested request from, you know, their chief or their captain. And again, same thing with them. If they choose to leave, there's usually some sort of repercussion. So that's helpful for us as a treatment provider to be able to kind of unite with not only the family, but also the employee assistance program or the peer support person, when that individual is having a tough time and saying, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to go home. And we can say, well, listen, let's get your wife on the phone. Let's get your husband on the phone. Let's call your peer support person. Let's kind of talk this through. You know, if you leave, what are the consequences? And then if you want to make that decision, that's fine. But at least let's kind of have all of our, you know, all of our ducks in a row. So we know if we, you know, make this decision, maybe we can't go home tonight, or we might be in danger of losing our job. So it helps us as a treatment provider to make sure that we all do stay on the same page. But there, it is in essence, not a locked facility. So people can make the choice to leave, which sometimes they do, unfortunately, and it does result in them losing their job.
If there's an officer, a firefighter, a dispatcher, a first responder, and they drink socially, at what point is it, should they consider, okay, maybe I do have a problem? What are some of those symptoms that say, hey, yeah, this keeps coming up. Maybe I need to go see somebody.
It's a great question. So I think one of the first things I always think about is the why. So why are you picking up a substance in the first place? And then the next question is, what happens when? So are you picking up a substance once a week because you had a tough shift, because you had an argument with your spouse, because you got upset with your kids, or you're stressed out, or whatever the case may be? Or are you picking up a substance because you like the taste of a beer when you're drinking dinner, or you like a glass of wine, you know, at the end of your day? So I think that those are some of the things to consider. And then when you drink, what happens? Are you having arguments with your spouse? Is it impacting your, you know, job performance? Is it impacting your family life? So I remember very early on when I got sober, I was 19. And so I was in, you know, AA meetings and NA meetings with people that were 40 and over. It wasn't really a thing back in 1997 that teenagers and young adults were getting sober. And so I would compare often to, you know, I was like, well, I didn't lose a car. Well, I didn't, you know, do, you know, I didn't lose a job. I didn't do any of these things. And they would always say, don't compare, you know, your story with somebody else. But what you want to look at is like the feelings behind, right? So we use substances to mask because we don't have any other coping mechanisms and we don't have any other tools in our toolbox. And when we get upset or sad or mad, the first thing is we're going to use a substance because that just alleviates that pain immediately. So it's always the why, and then what happens after? Was there a car accident? Have you had a DUI? Is there often, you know, fights at home because of your drinking, or you getting in trouble at work because you're drinking? Those are some of like the red flags, I think, that I would tell people to kind of keep an eye out for. And that helps you kind of differentiate. Are you just drinking socially, or is there maybe a problem? And you could have a problem and not necessarily be an alcoholic yet also. You know, so it's good for you to kind of be mindful before things get out of control. You might be able to course correct.
Mm-hmm. What about someone who says, yeah, but I enjoy having a glass of wine occasionally. I just don't know if I can just live without that ever again.
Yeah. Imagine saying that to yourself at 19. I had to go through my 21st birthday sober. So I didn't get to do what most 21-year-olds do in like party like a rock star and, you know, forget everything that happened the next morning. I always say it's not forever. It's just for today. I know people that were sober for 5 years, 10 years, you know, and they drink socially now. I couldn't do that. I know myself. I can't even, like, if I'm doing a specific diet, I can't even have a cheat day because that cheat day explodes into I'm now eating carbs full time again, just because that's my addictive personality. So that could have maybe been someone that he or she was a problem drinker, kind of course corrected, and maybe after a period of time found a way to, you know, drink socially and not have a problem with it. I think a true alcoholic, you know, can't ever really drink in safety. Like there is just no such thing. We just don't know what one means. Like you don't ever leave half of a drink and walk away. Like those things are just, we kind of, people like myself look at, you know, people who do that and we're like, what are you doing? There's still alcohol left in there. Mm-hmm. You can't just leave that and walk away. So those are some of the kind of things that help differentiate, I think, like a social drinker from a problem drinker, an alcoholic.
And so it's really about knowing yourself, right?
Yeah.
What's that process like of kind of figuring out who you are and how you operate?
Still figuring that out 26 years later. You know, it's, I think that I'm grateful that I'm a recovering alcoholic. You know, it gave me an opportunity to learn so much more about myself and to find these tools in my toolbox and just to continually improve and evolve kind of who I am. I think, you know, obviously when I was using substances, I was never comfortable in my own skin. That's why a lot of us use substances, whether we don't have any self-esteem or, you know, we don't like the feelings that we have based on childhood experiences. There's sadness, there's trauma, all of those things. We're living in fear. To be able to put down those substances and then face those hard truths is pretty, I want to say powerful, but it's also, I don't know, it makes me even more confident. Every time something happens in my life, I'm like, this is just another opportunity for me to show that I can overcome. And it's just a kind of a building block, and I continue to get stronger and more confident. And I just am less affected, I guess, by the negative things that happen. I remember really early on when I first got sober, like I was just a kind of like a, people used to use the term stark raving sober. And that was me at 19 years old. I had no coping skills. I had no tools in my toolbox. I just knew that I didn't want to use substances anymore. And that was the one thing I did successfully. But my life was like, still kind of unmanageable for a long time. You know, it was like, okay, I'm not using substances, but I'm still doing all these crazy things. And then it's like, okay, I'm not doing substances, and now I've got this under control, but I'm still doing all of these other things. And so it's just like taking one step every day in this direction and continuing on this path. And, you know, 26 years later, I'm still in therapy. My therapist is a huge part of my recovery. And I also am doing EMDR therapy, which is really great for first responders and, you know, helps me with like my childhood trauma and all of that stuff. So I'm still peeling back the layers of the onion. And I would encourage people to never stop peeling back the layers of the onion, even if you're not in recovery. I mean, we all have had some kind of something happened in our life that changed kind of who we are. But that doesn't mean that it has to stay that way or that it has to negatively affect us. We can use it in a way that can kind of help promote growth. And we can just become still who we were intended to be. It's just a little, you know, it's a little bump in the road.
Yeah, it is a process. And I know just in my own journey of you know, kind of some of the limiting beliefs that I've had from a child, you know, and those are things that I'm still working on. I'm still every day have to work on those to get me to where I want to go. And yeah. I love what Craig Rochelle says. He's a pastor, but he wrote this book about the mind. He said, our life moves in the direction of our strongest thoughts. And so, you know, if I want to go someplace, if I want to achieve something, then I've got to start moving in that direction. I've got to move heaven and earth to get there. Yeah. But it's a daily process to get there. And so if I want to be healthier, if I want to be sober, if I want to, you know, achieve these things, then I have to work on that every single day.
I love that. It's true. And, you know, we just wrapped up November. November is always gratitude month for me. And I have a radio show. And so the topic is always gratitude. And a few years back, I met a master resilience trainer who taught me this gratitude skill. And I was always a cup half empty kind of person, believe it or not. Even in my recovery, I was always a cup half empty. That was just my personality. And that's what I told myself my whole life. I'm like, that's just my personality. Like I plan for the best, you know, like hope for the best, but plan for the worst. Right. Mm-hmm. Because that was just what life taught me is it was just, there's always challenges and it's never been easy. And so that was kind of my mindset. in this Chris Poe, he's an Army drill sergeant, retired now, and he was a master resilience trainer in the Army, and he said, you know, I want you to write down three things you have to be grateful for every single day. Focus on those three things and do that for 30 days and watch your mindset change. And it did. It changed within before the 30 days. And I used to, you know, struggle to find three things to be grateful for. And then by the end of the 30 days, it was like, I would struggle to find things that I was not grateful for, you know, because I was just training my brain to focus on the things I had to be grateful for and just constantly looking throughout my day of things I could be grateful for. So I could remember in the morning to like text and say, I'm grateful that this happened, or I'm grateful for this, or I'm grateful for that. And I actually did that with a colleague last year, and that colleague was the same as me, cup half empty, very, very negative. And I watched him transform over the 30 days, and it was beautiful to see. So we can change our, you know, thought patterns and processes. I don't like it when people say, you know, that's just how I am. I'm like, that's how you're choosing to be, but you can change. It is possible.
Right. So if I'm a first responder and I may have a little bit of an alcohol problem, where does it come? Where is the importance of like a 12-step program versus going into full-on treatment for 30 days?
Great question. So if you're a first responder and you're struggling, and I guess I would say if you're not sure it's a problem yet, I usually say, like, what are people around you saying, right? Is your spouse saying it's a problem? Is your work saying it's a problem? Or are you yourself just saying, I'm a little not sure about this? So if you're at the beginning stages where you're not really sure about this, you know, we have outpatient treatment. That's, I guess, probably where I would recommend starting, getting a good therapist that has experience with treating first responders with substance use disorders. And maybe just doing some outpatient work for a little while and just spending time kind of examining, what does this look like when you're drinking, why you're drinking, what happens. If you're not struggling with withdrawals when you're not drinking, then I'm going to say most likely you're not going to need a detox process, right? So if you're drinking daily and when you don't drink, you're having withdrawal symptoms, we know right away that you absolutely need detox. I will say people... you cannot die from opioid withdrawals, but you can die from alcohol withdrawals. It's very unsafe. So a lot of people are like, oh, I'm just going to do it at home. And I'm like, please don't do that. Like, don't do that. I've heard one too many stories of people trying to do it at home and losing their life because of, like, you know, comorbid, you know, diagnoses and things that, you know, you just don't know what can happen with your body when you remove that substance. So it's much safer to do it on an inpatient level. But if they're in the very beginning stages, I would say try, you know, working with a therapist and try some outpatient treatment. And then if you're drinking to the point where you're having withdrawals and it is a problem, then that's most likely going to require inpatient treatment.
Mm-hmm. And what's the added benefit of, say, an AA group?
So, I mean, we know there's badge meetings, right? And so badge meetings are kind of like, you know, undercover AA meetings for first responders. So it's just first responders. It's kind of interesting. In my first experience with a badge meeting, I had referred a friend of mine who was a police officer, had completed our inpatient program. And I said, hey, there's this great badge meeting in like this town, a couple towns away. He showed up to the badge meeting and he's like, Tara, they all put me up against the wall. And like, where did you come from? Who referred you? What's your name? Where do you work? Because people actually need to be vetted to go into these badge meetings, which I did not know, but now I know. So it's this kind of secret society for first responders, which I just love, because them feeling safe enough to open up is key. So if they're going to go to an open AA meeting and not feel comfortable there and not share or be vulnerable or, you know, receive because they're not able to relate, then it's not worthwhile. But I know a lot of first responders that feel comfortable, or nurses or, you know, veterans going to regular first responder meeting, regular AA meetings. Now, AA meetings are not all the same. And so that's kind of where I'm a little bit biased. So because my cup now is half full versus half empty, I prefer to go to big book step study meetings. And I find that those meetings are much more focused on the solution and not living in the problem. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I first kind of got sober and I was just going to like regular open, like, you know, AA meetings and discussion meetings and speaker meetings. And a lot of those meetings, I'm not going to say all, but a lot of those meetings is like, oh my gosh, you know, my boss, this, my kid, that, and today was such a tough day. And, you know, people kind of sharing a lot about like their drunk logs, if you will, which is can be triggering for some. So not all meetings are created equal. And I tell people, if you've gone to a meeting and you didn't like it, don't give up. Just try a different type of a meeting or try a different area, because they are definitely not all the same. But I mean, AA and NA saved my life in the beginning. I went to meetings every single day, probably for, I don't know, at least the first 1 to 3 years of my recovery. I mean, I was very hardcore. I chased after my recovery like I chased after my alcohol and drugs.
I know, you know, Maddie, the firefighter in my film, he still goes to AA meetings every day, every morning. Yeah. He's at 6:30 or 7 o'clock. He's at his meeting. And, so I've had the privilege of going with him to one of those meetings and being there. And I remember the first time I ever went to an AA meeting, I was invited to down to Washington, D.C. There's a group that's been meeting at DuPont Circle for 30 years.
Wow.
And these people, it was every walk of life you can imagine, black, white, straight, gay, just, you know, faith-based, non, you know, atheist, the whole gamut was there. And that was the first time ever in an AA meeting of any kind. And I was just there to observe and to kind of soak it in. And I was blown away. I was blown away by the love. I was blown away by their challenging each other, you know, holding each other accountable.
Yes.
And just, I had a religious experience there.
Yeah.
You know, it was just this spiritual moment, and it wasn't really even a faith-based group. It was just a secular AA meeting, you know, and it was really an amazing experience for me.
That's so cool. I'm happy to hear that. Well, you know, our 12 steps are biblically based, and, you know, we talk about, you know, giving our will and our life, you know, over the power, you know, a higher power. So, mm-hmm. For a lot of us, whether they, you know, you choose to call it a higher power or God or whatever it is, a lot of us have had a spiritual awakening, and that is what keeps us sober. We're seeing through new lenses. We have new set of eyes. We're looking at things differently. And that meeting is the way that things should be. And me being, you know, 26 years sober, I'm now kind of one of the old timers, which I don't love that term anymore. But that's how things were when I was kind of growing up in it. And I now, if I go to a newer meeting, I don't find that as much. It's almost finding a meeting like that is kind of like finding a needle in a haystack almost. So when you find it, you got to hold on to it, because those are special.
Mm-hmm. So what should someone do if they find themselves in this situation where they're struggling with this but they're in an agency that they could potentially be pushed to the sideline if they're found out? What should they do?
Yeah. You know, so getting help sooner rather than later is always key. You know, we have had, you know, officers arrested for DUIs in their cruisers in treatment with us, right? So it can get to that point, and it can get even worse. So I would love people to come to us before they even need detox, right? If they need outpatient level of care, they could maybe just do outpatient therapy, you know, do some meetings, get a recovery coach, course correct before, you know, you hit that bottom. And bottoms vary for so many people, and they just continue to get deeper. You just dig a hole. So starting off by just reaching out and asking for help, know that, you know, when or if you do that, everything is always confidential, especially on an outpatient level. If you utilize your insurance, obviously, you know, they're going to know you're accessing services, but not necessarily, they're not going to know if you're seeing a therapist, why you're seeing the therapist. And I think these days the stigma has turned where they're actually encouraging first responders to do this, right? Because we're talking more about like officer wellness now and first responder wellness. So I don't think that I guess, be any cause for concern. So I think that would probably be my first recommendation, is just finding yourself a good kind of outpatient therapist, and, you know, and possibly doing an, you know, outpatient program, you know. So I think the therapist would be able to determine that. That's kind of what I do as a treatment advocate. So, you know, I take phone calls like this every single day, and I, you know, talk to the individual, talk to the family, kind of ask those questions, you know, how much have you been drinking? How often, how long, you know, have you ever done treatment before? And then we kind of come up with a plan together. So, you know, the people can always just reach out to someone like myself, as well. That's kind of well-versed in what the continuum of care looks like, and go from there. Mm-hmm. And that's always confidential as well.
Sure. How important is it to have a sober buddy that can call your bluff?
Oh my gosh, it's so crucial. I mean, I probably have a couple. I have a very small circle, but I have a very trusted circle. And it is my least favorite thing to do, is to call somebody out. But I know that this day and age, that it's life or death. You know, whether someone is struggling with their mental health, or they're struggling with, you know, substance use, or they're in recovery and I'm concerned about behaviors that I'm seeing. And I'm doing them a disservice by not saying anything, as uncomfortable as it may be for me. But I do it when I have to. I don't like to do it, but I definitely do it, because it's not really about me. It's the other person. And, you know, it's not necessarily, I definitely have had people get upset with me and not talk to me for a little while. And that's okay if I helped them in some way, you know, because mm-hmm. it's not about me. It's about helping the other person.
Mm-hmm. I think just that accountability can help you stay. And if both of you are working through that, it'll help both of you to have that, to know that this person, they're going to call me out if I'm cheating.
Yeah. Iron sharpens iron.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you're a firefighter within an agency and all your buddies are going off to drink, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that I would like to encourage people to like find fun, sober things to do, right? Mm-hmm. Like challenge one another, be like, hey, have you tried axe throwing yet? It's like the new thing. Like, let's try that out, you know?
Probably not something you should do when you're drinking, right?
Not with alcohol. You want to do that sober.
For sure.
But just, there's so many different things. Pickleball, you know what I mean? Like going to the gym, taking a hike. There's just, it's endless. The possibilities are endless. I think that people just, it's easy to be like, hey, let's just go grab a drink. You know, it takes more effort to find a common ground and find a new activity, but I'm all about finding new activities. I love to try new things. Because how do we know what we like and don't like unless we try, you know, we try. So don't go to the bar with your buddies, like say, hey, can we do this instead? You know, hey, let's grab a bite, or, you know, go to a 99 or go to a pub at least where you can eat. And if they want to drink, that's fine. But, you know, you're not feeling well tonight, you're not going to drink. You're going to have a Shirley Temple, something like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. Or I highly recommend taking a bike and riding across the country too. So
nice. With a comfortable bike seat.
With a comfortable bike seat. That's a key. Exactly. this has been a great conversation. I think it's an important conversation, especially this time of year. And I'm going to make sure this episode comes up before Christmas comes, and the people can take a listen to this. And where can people reach out to you if they want to learn more about what you guys do?
Yeah. So, I always tell people, call me. I'm very accessible. You know, sometimes people call me and they're like, I'm sorry to bother you. And I'm like, please, like, you are not bothering me. Every time my phone rings and I can help somebody, it's just like another check in the checkbox. So it's never, never bother. I always give out my cell. It's 978-870-7734. My email is tara.rivera@banyancenters.com. And they can find our treatment center at clearbooktreatmentcenters.com.
And what's your service area? Who all do you serve?
So Banyan has, I think, 17 or 18. We're continually expanding, so I sometimes have a hard time keeping up facilities. In most of those facilities, we have veterans programs, but the first responder specific program is located in Massachusetts. So we do work with insurances all over, and there's different programs that we have to be able to help get people transport out if they do want to leave the state that they're in and come to Massachusetts. We get people from all over, believe it or not, mostly New England states. We also have a treatment center in Pennsylvania, so a lot of people actually will come from Pennsylvania to come to the first responder program. We've got people that come out from Florida, Texas. So it's definitely, I mean, it's a different type of program. It's a very special, you know, it's not just regular inpatient treatment. You're with other first responders, and it's definitely well worth it. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that change of scenery is good for you.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I only went 30 minutes away from where I originally was from, but my older brother, when he went into recovery, moved to the next state over. And then my younger brother actually moved to Florida, and he still lives in Florida today. And I think he's sober, I'm going to say 7 or 8 years. So,
yeah, I know I had a friend who recently went across the country to a treatment center, and it was really a huge thing. It really helped them a lot to get out of their situation and be able to see the world from a different perspective.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I agree.
So final question, what really kind of lights your fire with this type of work? What just gives you, just like, wow, yeah, I'm doing the right thing here. What's that?
Yeah. That's a loaded question. I mean, I'm a helper. I've always been. That's just kind of who I am. I'm very much like servant minded. So any way that I can help to alleviate stress, alleviate fear or worry or pain from somebody, and help them begin their recovery journey, whether they're a first responder, whether they're a nurse, or, you know, whether they're a secretary and, or, you know, a high school teacher, that brings me the ultimate joy.
So one more question, final question, I promise. What's something fun you're going to do in the next month?
Oh, fun. Goodness, I guess fun for me. I think that Sundays are my favorite days. And, I start my Sundays every day with church. And then I end my Sundays with Sunday dinner with my cousin and his family. And there's usually 15 to 20 of us every Sunday. So that's something that I look forward to every single week. And you know, we are going to have a big Christmas party, you know, not this Sunday, but the following Sunday. So that's probably what I'm most looking forward to. I will probably catch some shows too, cause we usually go to the local college and we watch, you know, Silver Bells or Elf or something. So that I always enjoy as well, but family time with families is just, to me, it's nothing better.
Well, Tara, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for what you do for first responders. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate your insights and wisdom that you have gained over the years and sharing that with my audience. So appreciate that.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
For more information about the treatment centers Tara mentioned today, please check the links in the show notes below. And please leave a review and give it 5 stars if you think it's worth it. And also, subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or on our YouTube channel, where you can access these interviews and other content as well. And remember, you are not alone. If you need someone to talk to and don't know where you can turn, you can always dial 988 for help. Until next time, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something good in the world.